Portland. The Finance Committee meets the fourth Monday of every month at 4:30 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of a discussion entitled Islamophobia and White Nationalism in Oregon and the World on Tuesday, May 28th at 7 p.m. at the Oregon Historical Society in Portland. In Oregon, as in other places, xenophobia, anti-Semitism, and Islamophobia have intersected to perpetuate white supremacist and white nationalist ideology. This panel discussion will explain those connections and will offer tools that individuals and communities can employ to help stop the spread of hate culture. Again, that is a discussion on Islamophobia and white nationalism in Oregon and the world on Tuesday, May 28th at 7 p.m. at the Oregon Historical Society, 1200 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm. On the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 10 o'clock. Time for the Heather McCoy Show.
Heather McCoy Show.
Welcome to the Heather McCoy Show. I just want to give a warning to our listeners. The show will discuss abuse, but it will also discuss healing. My guest for the hour is best-selling author and Tony Award winner Eve Ensler. Her new book is entitled The Apology. Welcome to the show, Eve.
Thank you, Heather. I'm thrilled to be here. Good morning, Portland.
Good morning. In your new book, The Apology, you wrote an apology for your dad, who has long since passed, to you for all the sexual, physical, and emotional abuse he inflicted on you for decades. Before you sat down and formally started writing this book, did you have an outline in your head of what an apology from your dad would look like if he ever recognized the wrong that he did to you, or was this like a clean slate?
That's a good question. You know, I think one of the things I discovered writing this book is what is a true, authentic, thorough apology. And I think before I began, I started to think, like, what do I need to hear? What do I need to feel? What are the words I need him to say? So I had, like, a kind of anatomical outline, right? Certain basic things, like, I need him to go into the details of what he did. Specifics. I need him to own it. I need him to talk about what his intentions were and what his malintentions were. I need him to look back at his past and his childhood to understand what were the things that happened in his life that led him to be a kind of man who could be a sexual abuser and a sadist. And I needed him to feel what I was feeling and what I felt when he did the things he did to me, so that his heart would break open and he could really become vulnerable and humble in making amends. And then I needed all that to kind of be come together in a realization that he would never be capable of doing something like this again. And that was kind of the blueprint I started with.
In the introduction of the book, you write, quote, "I am done waiting. My father is long dead. He will never say the words to me. He will not make an apology, so it must be imagined. For our imaginations, we can dream across borders, deepen the narrative, and design alternative outcomes. As a trans woman who's created an alternative reality for myself to stay sane and sober in an extremely unforgiven world, I often get stuck in my own head in alternative realities and forget to eat and go out of the house for days on end. When you're designing alternative realities and outcomes, what is the end goal and how does it stay within the realm of being healthy?"
Well, that's a good question. You know, I think what happened with me in this book is that once I went in, I felt like I kind of went into this strange trance state for like 4 months, and I just was in it. And during that time, I just reminded myself to eat and to exercise, because it was such a grueling physical process writing this book. And I think as we're creating our alternative realities, and as we're I mean, the imagination is so powerful. Sometimes I think it's more powerful than any force on the planet. And sometimes I think it summons up the truth and reality more powerfully than anything we can do. But I think while we're doing that process, we have to really take care of our bodies. It's so critical.
As far as like alternative outcomes, how do you see them manifesting themselves within the real world as far as like having a system of more accountable justice, for example?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think a few things. I think I wrote this book for a couple of reasons. One, because of the horrible abuse I suffered from my father. I think I've been waiting my whole life for an apology, and he died 31 years ago. Also, I look at the way so many of our sisters, you know, cisgender sisters, transgender sisters, everybody has been calling out and breaking the silence and telling the stories and making themselves vulnerable and bravely putting themselves out there. And, you know, I started to think, well, when has a man ever really apologized publicly in a thorough, deep, self-reflective, self-interrogating kind of way? And I realized I'd never heard it, to be honest with you, ever. So I said I was going to write what I needed to hear. And I think two things happened for, hopefully. I think the book can be I want to say something to begin with. It's not a prescription, it's an offering. There will be survivors who don't want to do this, and they never want to do this, and that's totally great. There will be some survivors who want to do this. But I think what I learned two things, that this book could possibly be a blueprint for what a thorough, deep, true apology looks like. And secondly, this is the thing that really kind of took me to another place. I think for many survivors, if we've been invaded by a perpetrator, and this goes for men as well as women, if a person has come into our body, if they've raped us, if they've beat us, if they've harassed us, if they've demeaned us, they've made their stain on us, and they live in us. And I know for myself, I was in kind of conscious or unconscious dialogue with my father for 60 years. And I realized in writing this book, by going into him and letting him come into me, I could move how and where he lived inside me. So over the course of the 4 months, I moved my father to this monolithic monster to an apologist, from this towering terror of a human being to a broken, vulnerable man. And that shifted everything inside me. So that I feel like so much of my life was lived in the vice of me being victim to my father. And now I don't feel like I'm in that story anymore. So it had an enormous impact on me.
Is there a danger of being detached in reality by putting him in this different space that never existed?
You know, I felt more in reality than I've ever felt in my life.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I was so inside the truth of that story and so connected to him in a way I could never connect to him in life. And I think in some ways that's the power of the imagination. I just got off the phone from the director of our incredible revolutionary center and sanctuary in the Congo, City of Joy, which takes care of 90 women for every 6 months who have been through serious sexual abuse. And she told me that they did the exercise a few weeks ago, and it had a profound effect on the women. And she said, every day there are piles of apologies that survivors are writing to themselves on her desk when she comes in the morning, because it's helping them so much articulate what they need to hear. And the fact that they're writing it for their perpetrators is actually very liberating, because they're allowing themselves to speak for them and give themselves what they need. I think the ideal, of course, is that perpetrators speak for themselves and come forward and be willing and brave and humble and vulnerable and loving enough to write and make amends and go through a journey of apology and a practice of apology that could free victims from carrying this pain. But if one can't get that, one can do it for oneself.
How do you get to that level of restorative justice in our society?
Well, I think it is the only place we can be headed at this point. our prisons are full, and we know how racist our systems are. We know how economically disadvantaged people are always the ones who suffer the most. And I think what I've learned, having worked in a prison for 8 years with, you know, women who were there for long-term crimes, prisons don't change people. Prisons don't transform people. Prisons don't offer processes and pathways to apology and reckoning. They just punish, and they make people more upset and more angry. And I think, and what I hope, is that we can begin to design processes where, for example, if I am abused by my father and I go and I tell a prosecutor what I want to go through an amends process with my perpetrator. And maybe we can create panels that evaluate and determine and vet how that happens. Maybe it's a year-long or a two-year process where you have to go through self-investigation and therapy and work with clergy on a spiritual level, and then you come and you make amends and you make apologies in front of a panel. I mean, there's all kinds of ways we could think about doing this, and I know there are so many people now working, doing incredible work in restorative justice, and I think it's the path. I don't think we can incarcerate 3 billion men.
Right? Yeah.
I don't think...
Yeah, it's not practical, but at the same time, like your dad, we'll get into this further, but as you write, your dad it clearly is a sociopath. Harvey Weinstein was a sociopath. Like, restorative...
I think in the cases of people who will not change, people who don't... Like, my father, I don't think, would have ever gone through this process on his own. I don't think Harvey Weinstein would go through this. I think if you're not willing to go through this process, then we have to think of alternatives. What are holding places where people like that go? I mean, you know, the people who refuse to change and the people who refuse to engage in some kind of restorative process, then I think there has to be alternatives for that.
But it does seem like a lot of the more high-profile perpetrators, Brock Turner, just to name R. Kelly, they don't seem really apologetic at all. It seems like part of the way they carry this out is they justify this to themselves somehow.
Right. There's no doubt about it. I mean, and I think again, it would have to be based on who is really willing and to go through a kind of restorative justice process, right? And I think that would determine a lot. And also, it's about consciousness. Like, it's like my father. I'm thinking, like, what would it have taken for my father to wake up, to break through his narcissism? Would that have been possible? I don't know. You know.
As you detailed in your book, you've survived sexual, physical, and emotional abuse. And as an adult, you survived alcoholism, suicidal ideation, as well as a host of other self-harming behaviors. Where in this book does it fit in the spectrum of healing from the havoc that your dad induced into your life?
Well, I think, I don't know about you, but for me, my life has been about trying to climb out of, rise from the ashes, you know, to climb out of the darkness that was descended upon me beginning at 5 years old. And I think I've done, you know, I was lucky when I was younger that I waitressed and I make money to go and try to get some therapy. And then I think I've tried every form in the course of my life, whether it's body work or breath work or, you know, and certainly writing and activism were the major tools for me to transform, you know, my pain. And I think all of that led to this place where I was finally able to write this apology for my father and actually feel my father's pain and feel what my father had been through, which I don't even know if I could have done 2 or 3 years ago. Do you know, it took me a long time to get ready to do that.
I know for me, writing stuff down usually creates a finality to thoughts or feelings that I have in a certain space or time. I understand why you would write an apology for your dad, an apology where all the right notes are hit, but what is the goal of publication? Are we just creating a discourse around what forgiveness looks like? Or is it a way to take these stories of abuse and trauma and take Me Too to its next plateau?
I think it's both those things. I think, first of all, I think when we talk about gender violence or violence against women, it's so broad. And I think what I wanted to do is be really specific about what it actually is. I think, too, I wanted to see if I could create a blueprint of what an apology looked like that could be modeled and adapted, possibly, and offered as a pathway. And I think we're at this point that we have called men out. We have broken the silence. We've told our stories. But unless men begin to change, unless men begin to enter into a dialogue which would be an apology with us, we're going to be banging our heads against the wall for at least the next 11 years is what we've been given with climate change. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think it's all those things. And I think it's also to say, you know, everything is found in the specificity, right? Liberation in the apology is found in the details. The more you get down to what it is you actually did, because I know you know this, we have like diabolical amnesia in this country, right? We have it in our families, we have it in our history. We don't even remember what happened yesterday, but we certainly don't remember robbing the land of America from the indigenous and killing them and raping them and murdering them, or the subsequent years of slavery of African Americans and Jim Crow onward to mass incarceration. I think what apologies do is they force you to remember. They say what occurred actually did occur. And in that remembering process, things get attached and things get defined. My friend who works for One Billion Rising was in the Philippines last week, and she brought the book to the comfort women who survived horrible rape camps of the Japanese for years when they were teenagers, and some of them were raped up to 50 times a day. And they have been waiting for 70 years for the Japanese government to apologize. Many of them have died, some are infirmed, and two of them who were there were holding up the book just saying, all we wanted was an apology. We would have accepted an apology had the Japanese government come out and said, we did this to you, it is real. And it would have freed our families from all the stigma that got attached to their families when their mothers came out and said they had been raped. Because rape doesn't just affect one person, it affects communities of people.
I just remember one of my favorite authors is Gore Vidal, and he would write about the United States of amnesia. It seems like one of our character traits as a nation. So on top of toxic masculinity, we also have to overcome our forgetfulness as a country.
Indeed. And I think apologies is a way to do that, because they force you to go back and track what actually happened, right?
Yeah.
They're kind of antidote to amnesia.
And then also within this national moment, where we have our big wet president who is pardoning war criminals. And so it seems like there's an acknowledgement of wrong, but then they want to, then the white privilege kicks in where it's just like, oh, we're going to pardon these soldiers who committed war crimes. So it seems like there's a counterbalance effect to the way that, like, we're trying to move this culture, like a reaction.
Exactly. Well, I think this idea of pardoning people without ever going through a process of apology or reckoning or accountability is ludicrous. And that's not to say I don't think people can be released from, you know, punished, you know, forgiven or released. But I think I've always been wary of that kind of forgiveness that isn't earned. Like, you know, we're always being told, forgive your perpetrator, let it go, why are you so hung up, blah, 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 blah. The truth of the matter is that there is an alchemy to an apology when you sit with somebody and know they have done the deep self-investigative work of analyzing and looking at their past and putting themselves to the guilt and to the pain of what they caused in someone else. And they've detailed the account and they searched their souls. You can feel it when they're making an apology to you. You know when it's thorough.
Yeah.
And I don't think we can talk about forgiveness until that happens. I think it's not authentic, and it skips a very basic step and it's kind of hollow.
As we were talking, you don't remember your dad apologizing for anything. My dad is from the baby boomer generation, and as a child and as an adult, he has said some really extremely messed up things to me without ever apologizing. In the book, you described the traits of toxic masculinity. Quote, I was brought up in a time when men were praised for controlling and withholding their emotions, where they were admired for their steady steadfastness and knowing the way. They never apologized. They never asked questions. They never explained. They didn't speak. End quote. How does culture break from toxic masculinity? Because it is at the root of so much harm.
Such a good question, and I'm sorry your father never apologized to you, and I'm sorry he said terrible things. I really am.
Yeah. Thank you.
You know, I think a couple things. I think my father said something else in the book where he tells me that to be religious as a man is to be a traitor to all men. And when that came out of his mouth in my head, I realized that the thing that's really holding up patriarchy is this refusal to apologize in a way. This refusal to acknowledge that you know what you're doing is wrong, right? And I think once a certain number of men begin to enter, brave men, enter into this process where they begin it, you know, I always go back to Castro saying it only takes 10% of the people to have a revolution. We just need 10% of the men to be willing to say, the suffering of my victim, the pain of my victim, the lifelong impact on my victim, is more important to me than my allegiance to a male code that is dying, right? And I'm going to step up, and I'm going to be one of those kind of men, you know, the first men who's going to be willing to crumble the columns of patriarchy, you know?
On the flip side of that, you have the man babies crying about a Gillette commercial.
Yes, exactly. But you know, the thing about it is, where do men get to express their feelings? Like,
yeah.
From the time, you know, from the time they're born, they're told to man up, not to cry, suck it in, don't ever show anyone you don't know what you're doing, don't ever be, like my father, he was adored. But adoration isn't love. Adoration is pressure. Adoration is you have to be somebody you're not. So what do men do with all those feelings? Tenderness, their desire to wear skirts, their desire to wear sparkle, their desire to be something other than this horrible male suit they're being shoved into. And I think all that stuff goes underground and eventually surfaces in violent ways.
Yeah, I'm thinking about adulation and being looked up to. I go back to the, I believe, 1953 movie A Face in the Crowd starring Andy Griffith, where he was Lonesome Rhodes and he was admired, and it made him a monster eventually.
Exactly. I think adoration creates monsters because you aren't allowed to be human. Like that story my father tells in the book about the bird, you know,
yeah.
where he was holding that bird in his hand and he loved it, and his mother comes and is like, drop the bird. And she wouldn't even let him pick it up on the ground. And the crushing of boys' souls, the crushing of their tenderness. Yesterday, this beautiful man wrote me a note on Instagram and he just said, thank you. We're talking about tenderness and how when we don't love our own tenderness, we crush it in other people. And I want to embrace my tenderness so I can be the man that I want to be, you know? So, yes, it's at the core of everything.
How much was your dad's behavior influenced by his parents who were disciples of Daniel, is it Gottlob? And basically, the way to control a child is to make it afraid, even a baby.
My father was so much of that punishment school. Like, the way you control your children is to terrorize them. And I was terrorized every day of my life. You know, I was always waiting for the scream, the whip, the punch, the punishment. And I think what I've learned, that we live in a very punishing society. America is very punishing. We see it in our insane mass incarceration. We see it in the way we love people one minute and then we destroy them the next. We see it in the gotcha mentality on social networks. We're always ready to punish people and get them and bring them down. And I think what punishment does is it just creates more punishers. And it creates more violence and it creates more rage and it creates more self-hatred. And I think we have to move as a culture, as a society, out of this mentality so that we begin to look at what would it mean to look at the roots of violence. What would it mean to look at how we got here? How have we gotten to a society where one out of three women, all women, are raped or beaten? And if we look at trans women, or if we look at Native women, or we look at African American women, the figures are so much higher. How have we gotten here? And that's what we have to be examining if we're going to find our way out of this.
I would also add that Dr. Daniel Gutlob is basically one of a long line of successions of like quacks in my lifetime as Dr. James Dobson.
Mm-hmm.
That, they utterly ruin childhood for a generation of kids.
Yeah.
And that seems like an American trait that we kind of have to break hold from, too.
Oh, absolutely. Turning ourselves and turning the upbringing of our children over to people who really despise children and have no idea about the gender or diversity or the beauty of each child being exactly who they're meant to be, you know, and forcing them into these conforming and straitjacket modes that destroy their souls, you know?
Yeah.
You know, we have to all listen to our own instincts about, you know, who our children are and loving them for who they are and nurturing them and not forcing them to be anybody they're not.
Do you have a general sense of the character traits that your dad expected from you?
My father was obsessed with honesty, which feels very ironic. I think I was obsessively honest to the point if somebody stole something in a classroom, I would raise my hand because I was sure I had done it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I was always sorry. I was always wrong. I was always bad, right? And I think, you know, discipline, hard work, honesty, you know, being quiet, never talking back, you know, following authority, you know, all of those qualities. And I think, you know, I don't know why I happen to have the personality of just refusing authority from the time I could speak. And I blessed that, even though it brought a lot of pain into my life. But I think we have to bring up children to trust their experience, to trust their instincts, to know what they know and to be who they are. And I think this requires doing the same to ourselves. If we don't trust ourselves, if we haven't allowed ourselves to become who we are, how can we do that for our children?
In the book, you write that the apology that your dad is writing to you from the dead is in a place of limbo, a place of void, on mourning and forever spinning with no trees, ocean, smells, or light. Quote, nothing but the reflection of what lives inside of me. Your dad died in 1987. Explain this concept of limbo further. And was your dad so stubborn that it would take 32 years in the state to finally sort out the harm and recognize that he did owe you an apology?
Thank you for your very careful reading of the book. I so appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
I think one of the things I learned in this book, and I don't want to sound way out there, but I think the dead are all around us. And I think the dead need to be in dialogue with us. I think there are souls who need to be freed, who didn't do the work in this lifetime. And at a certain point in the book, my father says to me, I would rather spin in hell than give up my male identity, right?
Yeah.
And look where we are in the world. We are just about to destroy, to create climate catastrophes so human beings become extinct. We are killing people in every direction. We are full of hate towards our beautiful immigrants. We are destroying all our LGBTQIA communities. We have a war on women. You know, economic inequality is morbid. And yet, people are still clinging to this male idea, this male identity about domination and growth and getting more and more for myself, for myself, for myself. And I think my father spun for a long time before he was ready. You know, and I do believe that no one gets out of here without having to address their misdeeds. I really believe that. And if there's any motivation for people to make apologies, it's we all carry the darkness, the shame, the guilt, the self-hatred of the bad things we've done to other people. They infect our lives, they poison our lives, and they make us sick. And the reason to do it is to get free. That's what we're doing here. Each one of us is trying to get free because we're here to love, and if we're not free, we can't love.
Is the literary construct of spiritual goo a substitution for justice in this lifetime, since justice in our society often comes up extremely short?
I think so. I think so. I mean, I think, again, we go back to the imagination. We have to start to begin to imagine what freedom would look like and what the pathways of to freedom would be. And this book is definitely an act of imagination, you know?
Yeah. You also write frequently in the book that you summoned your dad. After you wrote this, will you be summoning him again?
No, my father's gone. Really strange. He's gone. At the end of this book, when he says to me, "Old man, be gone," do you remember at the end of Peter Pan when Twinkerbell just goes into the, you know, ethers?
Yeah.
That's what happened. I literally experienced him go into the ethers, and he hasn't been back since. And I'll tell you something. My life was so ruled by this kind of paradigmic narrative of me being a constant victim to my father's perpetrator. It ruled my writing. It ruled my activism. It ruled my life. And I don't feel in that paradigm anymore. And I don't know where I am, to be perfectly honest with you, because I've kind of been, wow, where am I now? But I like it.
Yeah.
And we'll begin to see what happens next.
Yeah.
But I want to just say to all survivors, you know, that we get raped, we get abused, we get harassed, we get demeaned, we get degraded, and then we get told that we're broken and we'll be like this for the rest of our lives. And that's the second rape. The truth of the matter is we can get free. And all of us need to be working to get free right now, because we need all of us to be fighting back against the last breath of this patriarchal dragon, which is trying to bring us all down on every front. And the more free each one of us is, the more able we are to take on this fight that's ahead of us.
Your dad was 50. Your mom was 20 years younger. Do you think your father just settled down to have kids because of the social expectations of having a nuclear family in the 1950s and 60s?
Definitely. I think my father, I don't think my father really even liked children. I think they were just loud and messy and annoying. And I think he did it for legacy. And he did it because he was supposed to do it, but not because he loved children or was interested in nurturing them or developing them, you know?
Yeah.
They were just annoyances, you know?
Explain for the listeners the construct and the concept of what your dad calls the shadow man. Is this conceit necessary because somehow he still cannot come to terms of what he did with sexually abusing you? Or is it a way to obfuscate blame in his actions for some way? What purpose is it?
I don't think it was a way to obfuscate blame, because I think my father does take responsibility.
Yeah.
I think it was a way of explaining what happened, how all these feelings that he wasn't allowed to feel, he pushed underground, right? He wasn't allowed to feel doubt. He wasn't allowed to feel jealousy. He wasn't allowed to feel lost. He wasn't allowed to feel his tenderness. He wasn't allowed to feel any of those qualities. And so he pushed them down and pushed, and eventually they kind of... they metastasized into another being. He was a split-off person. So he could be very charming and very, you know, entertaining, and yet there was a whole other self of him that was alcoholic, that was raging, that was invasive, that was very, very hurtful. And I think this is true with a lot of people. You see people all the time saying, oh, that couldn't have been him. He was such a nice man, right? Oh, on my neighbor, he couldn't have shot up that whole school. I, you know, we spent the weekends together. I think because we don't give permission to men to be their full selves, to carry all their feelings, they split off and they create these characters, these shadow men, who then operate in ways where they're highly disassociated, don't feel what they're doing to other people, and almost can't control their behavior because that shadow man has been unleashed. You know?
Yeah. For your father's shadow man, he was a frustrated artist, and he didn't want to go in the corporate world, and he was very jealous that you ended up going into the arts. Was there alternatives to that alternative, or was that really the only thing that made sense to you at that point?
Well, I think, what is choice, right? I mean, choice is so culturally bound, right, and culturally determined.
Yeah.
And I think you have to be really strong to say, my instincts are telling me that I don't want to be an accountant. I don't want to be a lawyer. I want to create. I want to make magic. I want to write stories and tell stories. And I think if you're not getting supported by your community or your family or the collective, you're out on your own. And that's very scary for most people. So I think, you know, my father didn't make those choices because he wasn't brave enough to make those choices, you know? And
yeah, and
he had a whole culture telling him not to make those choices.
There's the thing in our culture as well, is when you have a green Cadillac and you have what looks like to be an upper middle class income, everyone thinks that everything is set for you when in fact it may not be.
No, it's true. You know, one of my friends who I've known since I was a little girl and who knew my family, she wrote me a email the other day after reading the book, and she said, you know, everything you're saying I saw as a child, and yet I didn't know what it was then, you know? And she just said, I feel so bad that we didn't intervene because we all saw it. And I think it's like inside outside. Like you have the, you know, we lived in an upper middle class community, white privileged community. We literally had a white picket fence. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Literally around our house. And what everybody saw was what they wanted to see. Because at that time, people weren't looking and certainly weren't ready to uproot what was really going on. And I think many families. I mean, I just have to look around to see how many traumatized people there are in this country. I mean, we are a traumatized country, you know, and it begins in the family.
How did you overcome your trauma? Give us a broad outline of...
Do you have 10 years?
Maybe I'll check with the general manager and see if we can go a little longer.
I feel like I've done every form of, you know, I've been in 12-step program. I did breath work. I did group therapy. I did incest group. I did, movement. I wrote. And I became an activist at a young age, really fighting to end violence against women and girls. And I have to tell you, writing and working in V-Day, the global movement to end violence against women, and 1 Billion Rising, and traveling the world and meeting women and listening to their stories, finding ways to join in solidarity with women across the world has been the most healing. Between the writing and that, that's really where I got healed. Because I think when we give people what we want the most, we heal that broken part inside us.
I just find it remarkable that you went through college basically on your own. You came from a girl that wouldn't barely talk and her hair was in knots to being a critically acclaimed writer. So it just speaks to the personal strength that you have to overcome
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Well, you know, I have to say I have met amazing people along the way, whether it was in 12-step programs or in my life, who reached out to me and offered me a line when I was falling through the earth, you know? And I think we can't underestimate how one person helping us, or one person loving us, or one person caring about us makes all the difference. So sometimes I think people are always like, well, what can I do? How can I help anyone? Reach out to the person next to you, because I assure you that person's been traumatized. And even to know that there's some one person who sees you and cares goes a long, long way.
So you also have a website that collects apologies and why they're important, and you can make this more of a collaborative effort as well. Tell us more about that.
Yes. Well, what V-Day has done is we've put out a website, theapologybook.net, and we've asked advocates and thinkers and all kinds of people to write in and tell us what they think an apology is and why it's important. And we're inviting people from across the world to send in their anonymous apologies to their victims, or to write an apology to yourself from your perpetrator and to send it in. We really want this to be a collaboration. We want everyone's best thinking on what is an apology, what is restorative justice. Farah Tanis from the Black Women's Blueprint has written a beautiful toolkit on the website, and wonderful people are writing in about what is an apology and why it's important. And we just invite everybody to participate and to really expand this dialogue and expand this conversation.
In the book, you wrote about every hard-earned inch you had to go to free yourself from your dad and pursue your dreams. It reminded me of a commencement speech given by Stephen Colbert at Northwestern in 2011, when he talked about participating in a sailboat race for 6 days and how every inch was earned. And then that perspective changed when he had to come home and he covered that same distance afterwards on a plane. Did you have a similar experience during and after writing this book?
Oh, that's interesting. That's interesting. I think probably. I think when you're in the midst of something, you know, it seems like it's completely impossible, and it feels so treacherous, and you're just climbing and climbing, and then later you look back, and I don't know, it's almost like some other force took over and it happened, do you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
My guest has been Eve Ensler. Her new book is The Apology. I enjoyed the book quite a bit, and I just want to thank you for joining me on the show this morning.
Heather, thank you so much. I can't tell you how much I appreciate your questions and the depth of your thinking, and thank you. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're quite welcome. And you are listening to The Heather McCoy Show.
You look like an angel. Walk like an angel.
Walk like an angel.
Talk like an angel. But I got wise. You're the devil in disguise. Oh, yes, you are. Devil in disguise. You fool me with your kisses. You cheated and you schemed. Heaven knows how you lied to me. You're not the way you seem. You look like an angel.
Walk like an angel.
Talk like an angel. But I got wise. You're the devil in disguise. Oh, yes, you are. Devil in disguise. In heaven, but I was sure surprised. Heaven help me, I didn't see the devil in your eyes. You look like an angel.
Look like an angel.
Walk like an angel.
Walk like an angel.
Talk like an angel. But I got wise. You're the devil in disguise. Oh, yes, you are.
The Heather McCoy Show.
And welcome back to The Heather McCoy Show. In the final few moments, I want to go further in depth about a topic I've been mentioning in passing multiple times, which is how much I hate Meet the Press. And it's not just Chuck Todd. His predecessors are no better. I know that Judith Miller gets a lot of flack for her faulty reporting leading up to the Iraq War, but she did not. She did not exist in a media vacuum. There are bad shows like Meet the Press. Which would recite her reporting in interviews to most likely her source, Dick Cheney, who her predecessor, I even forget who his, what was it, predecessor? Oh, Tim Russert. That's who that was. So it made like a circle chain between Judith Miller, Dick Cheney, and Tim Russert from Meet the Press. Lewis Hill founded KPFA in Berkeley because he saw how commercial media liked to rush to war. The war drums are now beating again, and this time with Iran. Last week, Chuck Todd had on Republican Senator from Arkansas, Tom Cotton, to discuss abortion and intelligence reports regarding Iran. When asked about the President Trump wanting to sit down and negotiate with the Iranian government, he said this.
Iran is an outlaw regime that for 40 years has been waging a low-grade war against the United States. You know, that war has turned hot at times. In the 1980s, they attacked American-flagged vessels in the Persian Gulf. In the Iraq War, one of the deadliest bombs was smuggled in from Iran. They have the blood of over 500 dead Americans on their hands. Some of those Americans, as I write about in Sacred Duty, would be buried in Arlington National Cemetery.
Notice how he works in a book plug in that? He has a new book that he's promoting about Arlington Cemetery, and he worked in a book plug right in the middle of his war cry. So Iran is an outlaw regime. Notice that his timeline is only 40 years and doesn't mention the fact that this country supported a coup against Iran, basically we overthrew a democratically elected Mossadegh in 53. And that part's not talked about and at all. And so there's a whole history there. And then Chucky asked Tom Cotton about his support for regime change, and then he lets this statement out full of cognitive dissonance.
No one, to my knowledge, is proposing what you saw in Iraq with 150,000 troops massed to invade a country, overthrow its government, and try to govern 80 million Iranians. We'd like 80 million Iranians to be able to live in a normal country that doesn't try to overthrow
other governments in the region. So you're not advocating regime change.
Terrorize the world.
So they, if you didn't hear that, there was a lot of crosstalk in between that. Basically, Tom Cotton saying that he doesn't want the Iranians to live with a government that goes around overthrowing governments while talking about overthrowing their government. Yikes. So with this amount of, I don't know what the word would be, maybe with this much, like, dishonesty within the conversation, the topic is also included in abortion last Sunday. Basically, they talked about the amount of states which are passing an extreme legislation to prohibit the medical procedure. Tom Cotton, who is presumably a lawyer, for some reason does not like the courts. He brings up unelected judges multiple times, and it's almost as if he was a broken Rubio bot from the 2016 election debate.
One of the problems of having unelected judges in Washington make that kind of decision for us as a nation, I think that's the kind of common ground that we can look for right now, while a time when unelected judges are still setting the basic rules on this very passionate issue. That's why I say that one of the major problems of having unelected judges make these kind of decisions is we don't have the ability to have those democratic debates without playing within the guardrails that unelected judges have put up in this country.
So before he said it four times within a span of, I don't know, 8 minutes, maybe 7 minutes, and I just stuck them all together right in a row. I just don't know if Tom Cotton, and this would be the question that Chuck Todd should ask if he was an actual, you know, a journalist without his head up his rear end. He would ask if Tom Cotton knows that the judiciary is a co-equal branch of government, right? That would be the question to ask right there. Nothing. Just lets them go on. And I realize that these are 15-minute interviews and you can filler your buster your way out of them, and that's what most of this interview was. I'm just playing the things where actual things are said and there's no follow-up whatsoever. And this also doesn't include, he's demonizing judges, and the greatest accomplishment of the Trump administration, which does not get enough press, is how much they've stacked the federal court system with lackeys from the Heritage Foundation. But yet that's not good enough for Tom Cotton, who pulls out the good old Republican talking point of unelected judges. Moving on, basically Chuck Todd asked him twice about at what point does a fetus have constitutional rights. Tom gives this response and part of this response to that question.
What I'm most proud of here in Arkansas is that we have recognized that the frontiers of medical science are being pushed back.
So basically, he brings up science a lot in the interview, and he also says that it's... we have to decide what we want to do with abortion in a civilized society. I forgot that somewhere in that my computer is that clip, but I don't have that one. And so it's funny that Tom brings up civilized societies. This is another question I don't hear Chuck Todd or anyone from the Washington Press Corps ever ask, is like, does Tom want to stand with countries like Sweden, Cuba, Cambodia, or Vietnam that allows abortion? Or does he want to stand with his dreaded foe, Iran, as well as Saudi Arabia and the Dominican Republic? Easy question there, Todd. Like, the reason why he has a job is he's a tool. I mean, that's the reason why I don't have that job. And then so he just lets that go without comment. And at all. And then the science thing I just played, I'll play that one again because I knew I'm dyslexic and I knew I forgot to load one of them in.
What I'm most proud of here in Arkansas is that we have recognized that the frontiers of medical science are being pushed back.
So he brings up the science quite a bit. And so finally, Chuck Todd improvises this question.
Should this be a political decision or should this be a medical decision? I say this, you brought up the science and you talked that the Arkansas bill was trying to match the science. Should you guys be getting a panel of medical doctors to decide, okay, this is when a fetus is viable, therefore the here? Should this be decided by medical professionals and not by, frankly, I don't think you or I went to medical school?
Chuck, medical science, of course, informs these decisions, but ultimately these are moral questions. But
They're moral questions. They're not science questions. Yeah, that's because Tom Cotton knows the science is not on his side, and he's just another theocratical ass. And, like, this just flies every Sunday on Meet the Press, and it just drives me absolutely mad, as you can hear on this here show. This is the Heather McCoy Show. I'll be right back with just an assorted news from around the country and around the world right after this. Welcome back to the Heather McCoy Show. I want to wish everybody happy belated World Goth Day. That was yesterday, and that's why I played that song, was the throw out to she's been listening to a lot of Joy Division lately. I have not been listening to a lot of Joy Division lately, but I've been listening to other goth music. In other news from around the country, in an article that I swear is not from The Onion, a former Indiana House Representatives member wants self-Bin mayor and presidential candidate Mayor Pete, we'll just call him that, to denounce two sex acts which are associated with gay people. Don Boyes is the man in question, and if you're keeping score at home, yes, Virginia, he is a minister. In his blog, he graphically describes gay sex scenes while maintaining that in order to replace Donald Trump in the White House, Mayor Pete must be a, quote, clean gay. All this and more is posted in a blog entitled, Pete, since you brought it up, how gay are you? Yeah, I think it's been said multiple times, and it's worth saying again. The reason why you catch all of these like right-wing evangelical preachers and stuff in like gay sex acts is because they think about the actual sex act more than they actually think about like two consenting adults loving each other, and that's all that they can get in their brain is, oh my god, they're kissing and more that I can't say on the radio. And that's why you get the guy from Colorado Springs, Ted Haggard, from 2006 when he was using meth and having sex with male prostitutes, which if you're having sex with male prostitutes, that's fine. I don't care. I'm a libertarian in that side. But at least be, you can't be anti-gay while you're having sex with male prostitutes. That's the part that kind of gets you in trouble. That felt like I was kind of channeling Church Lady from Saturday Night Live there. So anyways, Politico and other LGBT news, Politico is reporting that the Department of Housing and Urban Development has announced it's going to be removing protections for homeless trans people by allowing government funded shelters to discriminate based on gender identification. Under the previous Obama administration, HUD made it a rule that required government-funded single-sex shelters to, quote, provide equal access to programs, benefits, services, and accommodation in accordance with an individual's gender identity. A spokesman told Politico, quote, later this year, HUD will be proposing a change to the 2016 rule that will offer local homeless shelters providers greater flexibility when making decisions about individuals who may be misrepresent their sex to access sex-specific shelters. I'm sorry, trans people are real. We're very real, and we're not misrepresenting everything. I'm Heather. I'm legally Heather. I've been Heather my entire life, and I've only been legally Heather for 10 years, but I'm Heather. Leave me the hell alone. According to the U.S. Trans Survey, 1 in 3 trans people have experienced homelessness some point in their lives. And I am definitely one of those. I'm one of those 1 out of 3. I was homeless and I was saved by a very nice person who her name's Bertie Reed. She lives in Southern California. She went to the UU Church where I was a member, and she actually took me in when no one else would do so. Basically that is the show, the big show, the Heather McCoy Show. Coming up next is on Book Waves. They're gonna feature a 1994 interview with Joseph Heller, author of the classic novel, there we go, Catch 22, which has been adapted into a mini series on Hulu. Then at 11:30, it's Words and Pictures, and then at 12, the music will continue. At 4, the PA afternoon PA block starts, and here it is. Oh, I can't think of the word I use. I'll just call it what it was. And here it is. Your moment is in.
We would rather avoid. We would rather just say, yeah. Oh, yeah, it's time. Come on, guys, put your hands up. You know, God is good. God is good all the time. And yet we got half the Christian marriages ending in divorce. Men in the church are jacked up on pornography. And with all due respect to Promise Keepers, man, do it. Stay in your lane, but a year at AT&T Stadium. There's dudes dying right now. And I'm not professing to say, Ken Harrison, I know how to do your gig.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 10:58. Up next will be Book Waves, featuring a 1994 interview with Joseph Heller, author of the classic novel Catch 22, which was just adapted as a miniseries on Hulu.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Bodie Phelps Angelversary and Protest on Friday, May 24th at 11 a.m. at Gresham City Hall. Bodie Phelps was 22 years old when two Gresham police officers shot and killed him on May 24th, 2016. The gathering remembers Bodie Phelps with speakers, flowers, candles, and protest against police murder. Again, that's Bodie Phelps Angelversary and Protest on Friday, May 24th at 11 a.m. at Gresham City Hall, 1333 Northwest Eastman Parkway in Gresham. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Grendel's Coffee House, located at East Burnside Street and 8th Avenue in Portland, offering organic coffee, sandwiches, and more for breakfast and lunch. Grendel's Coffee House is open daily until 6 p.m. More information on the Grendel's Facebook page and by phone at 503-595-9550. That's 503-595-9550.
Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. Since its original publication in 1961, Catch-22 by Joseph Heller has become a classic of anti-war literature, gaining fame during the Vietnam War for its dark and satirical look at American military life. Filmed to middling results by Mike Nichols in 1970, a new miniseries on Hulu has brought the novel back into the spotlight, where its focus on circular reasoning and insanity seems apropos to life during the current American regime. Catch-22 was Joseph Heller's first novel. In the 1970s, he wrote the novels Something Happened and Good as Gold, and in the 80s, God Knows and Picture This, and the nonfiction No Laughing Matter about his struggle with Guillain-Barré.